This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, Australia's only LGBTIQ+ national news and current affairs show. Proudly sponsored by KHQ Lawyers. Passionate about being the best.
Aboriginal author Bruce Pascoe has come under attack this week by who else but Andrew Bolt over the historical accuracy of his book Dark Emu, which is set to be adapted into a documentary. There has also been a website set up by an unknown person that attempts to inaccurately discredit Dark Emu. This website was investigated by The Informer's Toby Halligan, who judged it to be consistently inaccurate, poorly researched, and in some cases entirely false. Dark Emu has won multiple prizes and sold over 200,000 copies. It uses primary sources of historical information to paint a picture, of a sophisticated Indigenous Australian civilization that existed around the time of the arrival of white settlers and helped change our understanding of Australian Aboriginal history. Toby Halligan spoke to Bruce Pascoe about his book, the recent attacks against him, and what Australians can learn from Aboriginal history.
So many of first entries into country of European heritage described what the country they saw as being like a gentleman's park. They just thought Australia was like that naturally, unaware that Aboriginal people had cultivated the land into that shape, and that the grasses and the verdure that they talk about were in fact Aboriginal crops. So this elegant landscape of green fields and large trees dotted around rather aesthetically is, and I'm using the words of explorers, was a manicured land made by Aboriginal people. And so many first entries into country extol its beauty, and you know, it's a great shame that sheep did so much damage so quickly to that country. And the fact that we ceased the burning regime of Aboriginal people further led to the degradation of that landscape.
And throughout the book as well, you note the extraordinary technological sophistication that so many different Indigenous clans and groups and families demonstrated. Why do you think it has taken so long for Australia to reconcile what really was kind of staring a lot of people in the face?
I think there was a concerted campaign to denigrate Aboriginal people in order to justify the dispossession and the acquisition of the land. I think it was just colonial rules. One was that if you're a Christian nation and you want to steal land, you have to render it into terms that don't break the Ten Commandments. So it was, you know, just part of the colonial policy, and it was most firmly refined in Australia because every other continent had been overtaken by the Europeans, and so their skills when they reached Australia were at their peak. But it's extraordinary to think that you could read those histories, those journals of the explorers, the journals of the first entries into country, and not understand that Aboriginal people had been employing agricultural techniques. But that denial is still going on today.
You've been just exceptionally like polite and dignified in the face of, frankly, you know, some quite hysterical all-caps claims from Andrew Bolt. I'm quite interested in how do you maintain that sense of perspective in the face of that kind of really, really personal and frankly, offensive attacks?
Well, I've been taught by very good people. My mother's son, my grandmother's grandson, you know, two of the world's best people. But I've also received my law from a man who received his in unbroken line. And the essence of that law is discretion and modesty. And, you know, obviously I'm continuing to get advice from those people, considering the circumstances in the press right at the moment, and all urge me to follow my law. And that's what I'm doing. It's not as easy as perhaps it seems. These attacks are personal, attacks on my family, and it is hurtful, upsetting, distracting. I've always said that my Aboriginal heritage is a distant one, you know, but I've got birth certificates to confirm it. I'm not going to engage at such a petty level. You know, there are more important things to do.
When you speak to audiences or when you engage with people who've read your book, what kind of reactions do you tend to get from people?
An overwhelming support. You know, the book has sold nearly 200,000 copies, and perhaps that is what opponents least like about it, that Australians are willingly accepting a different way of looking at the history. Not a different history, but a different way of looking at the same history. So there's an enormous support for this in Australia. This is our opportunity to have a better discussion, a more dignified discussion, and a more healing discussion. I think this is a way for Australians to come together. And I've been really disappointed and demoralised because I wrote the book Dark Emu, and it's dedicated to the Australians. That means all the Australians, not just European Australians, not just Aboriginal Australians, all Australians, in the hope that we would have a better discussion. So I'm kind of shattered that this division has occurred, because it was my ambition that we would come closer together, not further apart.
Recently, Australia has faced some, we're perhaps facing one of our worst bushfire seasons within memory, and it's just beginning. What do you think that modern Australia can learn from its first inhabitants?
In the early stages of the colony, bushfire was a rare item. It was only after 5 or 6 years when the small saplings and the bush started to regrow that we got in peril. We got trees growing closer together with their canopies touching, and that a time bomb for fire in the country. Aboriginal people had manicured the land, so there were fewer trees, but they were larger trees, and their canopies didn't touch. The branches were further off the ground, so therefore any fire that did start couldn't reach the crown of the trees. It's the crown fire, which is the destructive one, that has been so awful for the people of New South Wales and Queensland already this spring. We're still in spring. This is the frightening thing. We have to get back to something like that. We will never return to how it was, because private property prevents us from doing that. Whatever we decide to do, it's going to take us 70 years. We're not going to achieve it in 5 or 10. We're going to have to wait until we allow these trees to become big trees, and then we have to prepare the ground beneath them. It's going to be a challenging conversation for Australians, because so many Australians love the bush as it is. They love the density of the smaller eucalypts together, and we have to imagine a different place. We have to work towards it together. I've got friends who hate the idea of fire in the bush because they're scared they'll lose their orchids, and they're scared they'll lose their golden wattle. But in fact, we can retain all of that. You know, orchids, in fact, love fire, but gentle fire, not wildfire. They need fire to restore them, not to cook them. These are difficult concepts. We have to work at it together, and we have to have this kindly conversation amongst us, so that those people who disagree are considered and cared for, rather than this thing where we get in trenches and just keep on firing bullets at each other forever. We have to work together at something.
What are you hoping that the documentary will capture and convey to Australian audiences?
Well, I hope it goes toward that conversation that I've been talking about, that considered, broad, humane conversation, not just about Australia, but about our planet, about human achievement. The thrilling thing for me is that during the process of the research, which is we've been doing now for over 6 months, that we've been talking to community and communities wanting to engage in this discussion. But in the process of it, just by accident, we've come across new archaeological sites, and they're of immense age and immense size and were unknown until a couple of months ago. It's going to be so interesting and thrilling for Australians to actually see these new sites, because even people on their own country hadn't seen some of these things. And to be with those people when they found them is one of the highlights of my life, to see what it meant for them to be on their grandmother's country and find these remote sites, which are so tellingly indications of a sophisticated society. That was a real thrill, and I think Australia can share that thrill.
Are there any sites that you would suggest that people around Australia can go to if they want to gain some insight into some of our remarkable Indigenous history?
Yeah, I'd go to the Koori Heritage Trust in Melbourne. I'd go to IATSIS in Canberra. You know, there are places in every city. Adelaide has several institutions. They're all around the place, and we're just getting used to this knowledge. But look, I'd visit Brewarrina, a place like Brewarrina, and look at the massive fish traps there. Lake Conda is an obvious one. World Heritage listed. Terrific guides and tours to be had there. But other communities are developing these tours. There's a great tour at Brewarrina, Mossman, Tasmania, all over the place. You know, in Margaret River, you know, one of the people working for National Parks told me an absolutely riveting story about the culture there. And you can go on that tour. These things aren't hidden from Australians. They're there waiting for us to take it up.
That was Aboriginal author Bruce Pascoe talking to Toby Halligan. This is The Informer.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.